Hi, this is Dark Journalist. On February 14th, 2018, former secret agent of the Houston Plan, Robert Merritt, had an exclusive interview with me here where he claimed that President Richard Nixon had placed a secret message to humanity in the White House during the Watergate scandal. This message contained the key to UFO disclosure and an energy formula that could transform life as we know it. In his third and final meeting with the president, Nixon told him of shocking events that would transform the world in 2020. It is with a heavy heart that I inform you all today that Robert Merritt passed away recently after a lengthy battle with illness. Today, I'm going to share with you some never-before-heard recordings of Robert Merritt's final testament with breakthrough information about the secret Nixon message. We'll also have Merritt biographer and Watergate lawyer Douglas Caddy with us to go deep into Merritt's incredible revelations and how they relate to recent announcements by the U.S. Navy of the danger of revealing classified UFO info, as well as the announcement of the Space Force by President Trump. Here we go, Nixon's hidden UFO disclosure message, the final testament of former secret agent Robert Merritt.
Space is open to us now, and our eagerness to share its meaning is not governed by the efforts of others. We go into space because whatever mankind must undertake, free men must fully share.
Because of what you have done, the heavens have become a part of man's world.
I occasionally think how quickly our differences worldwide would vanish if we were facing an alien threat from outside this world.
When it comes to defending America, it is not enough to merely have an American presence in space. We must have American dominance in space.
Undercover operative Robert Merritt had come a long way from his upbringing in West Virginia. By the time he had his three meetings at the White House with President Nixon in 1972, he had been doing undercover work as a confidential informant for the Washington, D.C. Metropolitan Police Department, the FBI, and the ATF. These assignments had him spying on different aspects of the radical groups that had caused so many problems for the Nixon administration. As a young man in his early 20s with an affable manner and friendly disposition, he could fit in almost anywhere. Later, he would be directed by these agencies to obtain lurid material that could be used to blackmail officials and congressmen. A snapshot of his covert work looks something like a mix of James Bond and government whistleblower Kathy O'Brien. In fact, his work was so pleasing to his superiors that he was profiled as the perfect candidate for something like an intelligence unit run right out of the White House called the Houston Plan. Essentially conceived as a kind of CIA just for the president, not much is actually known about this shadowy program. Some 31 pages of testimony regarding it from the Watergate era are still held under lock and key. Nixon felt he needed the advantage. Surrounded by domestic political enemies, he may have overestimated their chances for removing him in the 1972 election. Nonetheless, the Houston Plan and its star recruit, Robert Merritt, were busy performing covert operations and surveillance against Nixon's enemies. Merritt's third and final meeting with President Nixon came after the Watergate break-in. Nixon decided that Merritt was a man he could trust above anyone except his national security advisor, Henry Kissinger. He sent for Merritt in the usual fashion. After midnight, with no warning, a shadowy figure would come to Merritt's door and take him to meet with the president in a room deep underneath the White House. Nixon needed Merritt to be a courier of some special documents to a high official. The information was above top secret and referred to the UFO file. Merritt sat shocked as the president read the letter aloud. Now, Nixon was an experienced hand on managing the UFO file from his days as vice president under President Eisenhower. The government had a public program at that time called Project Blue Book, but according to several whistleblowers, Vice President Nixon personally ran the so-called CIA Blue Book cases, the real crashes hidden from the public that involved crash retrievals of exotic UFO technology. Before they said goodbye in this final meeting, Nixon told Merritt he had a special letter, a kind of time capsule, that would be discovered at a future date. This message in a bottle was hidden in plain sight right in Washington, D.C. Now, Merritt has kept these three meetings and the hidden information about Nixon's time capsule secret for over four decades. He revealed the three meetings and the secret message regarding UFOs in the White House that Nixon had vouchsafed for future generations on this program in February of 2018. What transpired after that and the further revelations regarding 2020 and the secret message is what we'll dive into deeply now with former attorney for the Watergate 7, Douglas Caddy. Doug, it's great to have you back on the show.
Well, thank you, Daniel, for inviting me to do so.
It's excellent. Your book, which came out now over a year ago and went over the kind of witness to history that you've been in various positions, as people know you most as being the Watergate lawyer, but you've also shown up in a number of fascinating cases, all the way from the Young Americans for Freedom to Billy Celeste's. And what I wanted to concentrate on today with you is the Robert Merritt story.
Yes, Robert Merritt, in my opinion, will turn out eventually to be a great figure in history. At some point, the historians will discover him. From the period of 1972 to 1974, he did extraordinary things that changed the history of the world. And that's what we're going to talk about today.
For those people who don't know, I mean, in your two books now, you've outlined the story of Robert Merritt, and I did an interview with him now that came out on February 14th in 2018 about his three meetings with President Nixon. But before we go deep into that, can you just give us a brief biographical sketch of Robert Merritt?
Well, Robert Merritt was born in 1942. He was born in West Virginia and raised in West Virginia. And he had the bad luck of being abused for 5 years, from ages 13 to 17, by two Catholic priests, which turned him from being a normal teenager into a sociopath, and eventually into a sociopath. And so in the final 3 months of his high school years, he couldn't take the abuse any further. He dropped out of high school, just 3 months short of graduation in West Virginia, and caught a train to Washington, D.C. And on that train was Martin Luther King and Martin Luther King's entourage. And Robert Merritt bonded with them because his father was actually Joseph Booker, who was the first Black American soldier killed in the Korean War. And so he really never knew his father and was raised by his stepfather, who also was very mean towards him. He loved his mother. He had a wonderful relationship with his mother. But he could not take the abuse any further, and so he went to Washington. And for the first few years, he had an ordinary life in Washington. He arrived there and had different jobs. And one of the jobs was being a soda jerk at a drugstore in Connecticut Avenue. And he lived about two blocks from the pharmacy where he served as a soda jerk. And right across from where he lived was the Soviet Chancery, the Chancery of the Soviet Union. And after a while, a man came in and sat at the counter. And it turned out the man was an attaché with the Chancery, the Soviet Chancery. And they bonded because the man wanted to have more contact with Americans, and here was a guy behind the counter. And it may well have been that they noticed that he left the his apartment house, which was across the street from the Chancery, every day to come to work. And that's why maybe the attaché sounded him out. But they developed a friendly, close relationship. They bonded and had wonderful conversations. And this went on for about a year. And then Robert Merritt one day was sitting in DuPont Circle. He was not working that day. And DuPont Circle was a main place to meet there in Washington, D.C. It was that actual circle where Connecticut Avenue intersects with the Massachusetts Avenue, about a mile from the White House. It's where the radicals and, well, I guess all the radicals in Washington gathered, and as well as the druggies and hippies and so forth. And he was sitting there, and these two men approached in suits, actually, and they stood in front of him, and they showed him photographs they had taken of him having his meals, breakfast meals, at the drugstore with this attaché named Boris, who worked for the Soviet embassy. And they said, "Are you a traitor? Why are you dealing with this man? We have these photographs, one after another." And he said, no, we're just friends. And he said, "Well, you can redeem yourself if you become a confidential informant for us." And he said, "Who are you?" And we said, "We're the CIA." And they produced their credentials. And you can become a, if you become an informant, you can redeem yourself. And here was a young guy and who wasn't even a high school graduate, though he had a very high IQ, presented with this situation. And so he agreed. He agreed. And so he became an informant for the CIA for 6 months and was paid quite decently, because he, much more than a soda jerk, was being paid. He kept his job and he kept up his relationship with Boris. But the agents told him they just had two assignments for him. One assignment was to become close, even closer to Boris, and find out as much information about Boris and what was going on in the Chancery as possible. And the second assignment was to get close to the founder of Scientology.
L. Ron Hubbard.
L. Ron Hubbard lived just about two blocks from DuPont Circle. He went to the DuPont Circle every afternoon to socialize. And he had a building nearby where Scientology and his different programs were being developed. And the CIA wanted more information about this. So those were the two assignments: stay close to Boris and get closer to Ron Hubbard, who Robert already knew in passing because they knew each other from DuPont Circle, and find out what was going on with Scientology. And as far as L. Ron Hubbard, Robert introduced L. Ron Hubbard to a beautiful girl from Georgia who was also part of the entourage that hung out there, so to speak, at DuPont Circle. And they hit it off. And Hubbard asked the girl back to his townhouse for sexual relations, and she agreed, but she said she wanted to bring Robert along. He said, "Why would you want to bring Robert along?" And she said, "Well, he'll stay downstairs, but I feel comfortable with him being there." And so the different occasions they had there in the townhouse, Robert remained downstairs. And but eventually the girl told him that she had also been recruited by the CIA. And so she was a CIA agent, maybe temporary one, and her assignment was to get close to L. Ron Hubbard. Uh-huh. And so after about 6 months, the CIA just reappeared and said, "Your assignment has been completed. Thank you very much. You did a great job." And that was his end of his relationship with the CIA. But it whetted, this relationship with the CIA whetted Robert's appetite, so to speak. And so he was receptive later on when he was approached by someone else who hung out at DuPont Circle. He did not know it at the time, but this was an undercover agent for the Metropolitan Police named Carl Schaffler. And Carl Schaffler was dressed as a hippie. He had a goatee and everything like that, dressed shabbily. So one night, this was about 1969, there was a knock on Robert Merritt's door. He lived actually right across the street from me on P Street, though we never met. And there was a knock on his apartment door. He lived in Hartnett Hall, which is a labyrinth of apartments occupied primarily by government employees. And there was Carl Schoffer. And Carl Schoffer said, I need to speak to you. And he said, why? And he said, well, he said, I recognize you from DuPont Circle. But he said, well, I'm an undercover agent for the Washington, D.C. Metropolitan Police, and I want to speak to you. And he stepped inside, and he said, we would like you to become a confident informant. We profiled you. We followed you for some time now, looked at what you're doing, and we think you'd be ideal as a confidential informant. Would you be willing to do so? And at that point, Schoffer pulled out $1,000 in cash and thrust it into Merritt's hands. And so that was rather persuasive to Merritt.
Back then, that was a serious amount of money.
And also, because of his CIA experience, he thought, well, this is another intriguing aspect of life, you know? Mm-hmm. So he agreed to do so. And the next day, Schoffer made a show of arresting him, so to speak, at the DuPont Circle in front of everyone, and then drove him down to the local precinct, leaving the impression back there that the police thought very badly of Robert Merritt. Well, actually, he went down to the police precinct to be enrolled as a special agent. He was given a number and began working for the Washington, D.C. police. And undercover on different activities, primarily Carl Schoffer was actually a military intelligence agent. He had gone to the CIA Vent Hill Farm. Actually, it was run by the NSA, but he had gone to the Vent Hill Farm station there in Virginia, where people were trained to be spies, spycraft. He was in the same class as Bob Woodward, of all people. They both knew that spy school at the same time. And they both received their assignments at about the same time. Carl Schoffer's assignment was to join the Washington, D.C. police. And Bob Woodward's assignment was to become a reporter for the Washington Post. And so they had developed a relationship at that time, which blossomed out when Watergate broke. But Carl Schoffer's assignment was primarily to follow the radical left, the idea that there was some terrorism going on by the radical left fighting the Vietnam War. Mm-hmm. And so he asked Robert Merritt to do these different things in connection with that, such as planting drugs on anti-war people, such as eavesdropping, reporting back what they were talking about. If there was a rally, he would cut the lines to the loudspeakers, doing all sorts of really unsavory activities as part of the work under Carl Schoffer.
And these are basically actions against the peace activists who That's are right. predominantly anti-Nixon.
Right.
Actually, when I first started working for the government in any undercover capacity is when Schoffler approached me. He'd been hanging out at DuPont Circle, where I wasn't many people, and it was a very diversified politically and cultural type of community there. Mm-hmm. I was involved in working for the police intelligence through Carl Schoffler. I was involved in a lot of different things. I mean, small assignments. I targeted over like 200 different political organizations, over a couple thousand private people. When I say a couple of those, I'm talking about stealing anti-war petitions, stealing their mail, breaking into places. This was on embassies. This was on the Institute for Policy Studies.
Now, you mentioned the Institute for Policy Studies there. Do you want to name some other institutions that were targeted?
There were so many, many offices around DuPont Circle that was involved in the anti-war movement, and also it was anti-Nixon, anti-government. That started, Daniel, like in 1968. And like I said, there was multiple organizations, people from every culture, every race, every class, every political factor, whether it's Republicans or Democrats, whether it was the communists, the Nazis, whatever, I managed to seem to touch base with them all.
Mm-hmm.
The FBI and MNA, they started asking me to target people, and I targeted over 70-some congressmen, senators, and ambassadors, and some people from the private sector to have homosexual sex with.
Right. And what you're saying is that they had you engage in these sexual encounters that they could document and record and then use against the people involved. Now, how was the surveillance carried out?
The FBI rented a room at the DuPont Plaza East Hotel, which was right on DuPont Circle, and the room was rented and maintained just for me all year round. And it was, of course, set up with very secret cameras and audio equipment everywhere. So when the door opened up, the machines came on. They were never discovered. And like I said, I'd taken over 70-some different subjects in there who I had filmed.
Amazing. And how would you describe your role in these operations?
I was just a mechanical prostitute robot. That's all it was. I just did whatever they wanted to at their request, and just in order to do the assignment and to get rid of the target. I had no personal feelings.
So would you say that these government agencies very much controlled your activities at that point?
They thought they did, and they wanted to. But if you read my FBI Freedom of Information Act papers, you'll see page after page after page that Robert Merritt was uncontrollable. He did, given an assignment, I would do excellent work, but I was described by my handlers that I would do excellent professional work, much more beyond their expectations of me. They were so pleased, and their supervisors were so happy with it, they were told just to leave me alone, let me operate independently.
Got it. They liked the results you were getting for them, the targeting of individuals, the sex blackmail tapes to be used as control files. You were excelling at the covert op missions that they were giving you. Now, after developing this track record, you were recruited into the Houston plan. The details about this plan are still shrouded in mystery, even all these years later, and the records of it are covered up even now. What we do know is this. It was a program that was submitted by Nixon aide Tom Houston for illegal activities, surveillance, break-ins, a kind of elite squad to be developed for intelligence gathering of the darkest kind. Now, how were you recruited into the Houston plan?
The Houston plan came about when I started working for MPD, Metropolitan Police Department Intelligence, with Dixie Gildon, G-I-L-D-O-N. At the time, she was a sergeant and moved up to lieutenant, was the last position in there. They gave me the Dixie. Dixie worked intelligence. And so did Carl, by the way. Carl worked for the police department. That's what he wanted people to think. That was the end of it. That's where he worked and nowhere else. But Carl was working for the FBI. He worked for the CIA. He worked for military intelligence. He worked for the Pentagon. He worked for Army intelligence.
Wow.
And the bottom line of this thing, he was basically military intelligence.
Now, as I understand it, Schaffler came from the military.
He was in the military. He did work intelligence, but it always maintained after he left the military and went to the police. The police, Carl, was just like a cover job.
Right.
So people wouldn't guess about the intelligence.
So they turn you over to Dixie. Now, what did you talk about?
She was afraid that I was going to quit on her without her, unless she revealed to me what she really wanted and expected from me. And then that's when she told me about the Houston plan, and that I was really getting paid, and my orders was going to come from them.
Uh-huh.
And the Houston plan was originally by a man named Tom Houston in connection to the president's request, and it was being done out of the White House. I was told that their motive was to phase out and get rid of, believe it or not, the CIA and the FBI intelligence.
This move by Nixon to create the Houston plan was an incredible gamble.
President Nixon wanted the intelligence under his control, directly under his control.
Uh-huh.
And that was the purpose of the Houston plan.
Coming up, Robert Merritt goes on the record about becoming a high-level courier of secret documents for President Nixon and learning of Nixon's secret UFO message. So President Nixon was setting up his own intelligence unit run right out of the White House, not to supplement the intelligence agencies, but he wanted to bypass them completely on his own terms. So they looked at the work that you had done, and they recruited you into the Houston plan.
Yes, I was their only recruitment, by the way.
Looking back now, does this invitation to be in the most covert of intelligence programs seem like it was arrived at by testing you with all of these various intelligence assignments?
I understand that it was because of the Houston plan. It was because of the White House that, where they were trying to direct me to go into, and they were the ones who were profiling me. They were the ones who was sort of grooming me, I guess you could say, to work for the Houston plan.
Right. So you were made into an undercover Houston plan operative. Then what happened?
I was given a code name, Top Cat, and code number. My code number was 003.
Mm-hmm.
And I made a reference to them about this. Well, does that mean that I'm before 007? I was referring to the movie before James Bond. They laughed, said, yes, said, we guess you had something over on him, so you were sort of the first.
Well, there you were, the ultimate agent of the Houston Plan, one of the most elusive covert programs in history. Now, your work with the Houston Plan led you to these powerful meetings with President Nixon. Can you tell us about that here?
There was only three. There was only three, Daniel. There was one, and that was like an introductory type of thing. Just I'll tell you one, and then that's how the others occurred.
Okay.
I was picked up like 3 o'clock, I think, was the latest they ever picked me up. But there's always, yeah, they were always after midnight hours. Here, I consider myself just to be a an illiterate, uneducated, uncultured hillbilly from West Virginia. I come to Washington, D.C. Here, I'm sitting in the White House with the President of the United States.
It's a remarkable journey, and I can only imagine your state of mind at the time. Now, the process of getting you to the White House also sounds unnerving enough. Can you tell us about that here?
I had no warning. I think it was about 2:30, 3 o'clock in the morning, but I have no idea. He never introduced himself, never showed me an invocation badge, nothing, but he just said that he was there to take me to the White House and that there was someone very big who wanted to see me. He did not say the President.
Hmm.
I trusted him as to his appearance without any identification. I mean, looking back on it, I mean, it could have been a kidnapper or a hitman to take me to my grave, you know, I don't know.
Yeah.
But anyways, he did drive me to the White House, and I went through to the Executive Office Building. At that time in the morning, the hallways were dimly lit. There was a security guard on duty. And we went in through a side door, like, on the front, down that long corridor to the rear of the building, down a small staircase to an elevator that was only big enough for maybe, like, three people to stand in. And I couldn't tell if it was moving. There was no dial on inside the elevator to say, you know, what floor you were on, nothing. And it didn't feel like it was even moving at all. I mean, it could have been moving sideways. I could not tell.
Hmm.
But anyway, when it did open up, we came out into several hallways that zigzagged around, and finally we came to a door that he opened up. I had a feeling that was the door leading into the White House, and it was. I mean, it opened it up, and there was a red carpeting there. The walls were not a scratch on them, not a flaw in the paint, nowhere. Rather fancy type of lighting, and it was a very, very long hallway, and we got to the end of the hallway. The person, agent, whatever it was, opened up the door, and the President was sitting behind the desk. He immediately got up, came over, shook my hand, and he told my escort, he said, go to the end of the hallway and stand there. He said, I don't want anybody by the door.
Now, what did the President say to you?
He noticed that I was visibly shaken by this whole thing, and he assured me that I was perfectly safe, and it was only to see him, to discuss certain things with him, that I was there to assist him, to help the country in what he called a national security matter. And he mentioned several things about the anti-war demonstrators and people who was on the far left that he considered to be a danger or upsetting to his administration and to the affairs of our country, which, of course, was just the Vietnam War that was going on. He knew everything about me, told me I had done splendid work. He had reviewed those reports and that I was the type of person he was looking for. I reminded him that I was just an illiterate hillbilly, barefooted hillbilly from West Virginia. And he laughed and he said, listen, he said, you're none of those things. And He said, "You're a very bright, intelligent young man. I admire you and respect you. He said, because you carried out all those assignments, and they were very happy, very pleased mm-hmm. with what you produced."
Now, what else happened in that first meeting?
Basically, Daniel, that was the first meeting. I mean, he talked about profiling me and...
That's fascinating. It sounds like he wanted to create a relationship with his main Houston plan operative, and you became a trusted source for the president at that point.
Yes, I did.
Now, it sounds like Nixon expressed his approval in how you carried out your covert assignments.
Absolutely. Yes. Yes.
So then that first meeting ended. What did he tell you as you left?
We would talk again, and he said, based on the fact as to who you are and the secrecy of these meetings, which he swore me to secrecy and to loyalty to him and to the country, that I would never divulge these meetings to anyone at that time.
Mm-hmm.
I never felt comfortable in divulging these meetings ever until just now. This is the first time they've ever been divulged. And I've done 558 shows, newspapers, magazines, the web, TV, radio, the whole nine yards. I've never talked about these meetings before. Never. Never talked about my meeting one-on-one with the President of the United States. Never.
Well, we're all very grateful for that, and I know the powerful place that your testimony is coming from.
This is the last expose of my life.
Coming up, Robert Merritt shares important details of his historic meetings with President Nixon in 1972.
Let's go into the second meeting that you had with President Nixon, which took place just before the Watergate break-in. Now again, an agent showed up unannounced after midnight to take you to the White House.
Yes, it was about 5 days before the Watergate, June the 17th, and the agent appeared exactly the same way, not the same agent, however. Again, these agents did not talk to me, no conversation, not even about the weather. I would ask them a casual question and be friendly with them. No response at all, nothing. And they just said, "We're to take you to your destination. I'm sorry, but we cannot have any conversation." That was their reply.
Now, how did you arrive to meet the president this time?
Same exact way, same building, same entrance, same elevator, and through the down the small staircase to a maze of different hallways and corridors, and until we reached the same door that led into the White House. The same way that Nixon was there and was waiting. Again, they were told, you know, to wait at the other end of the corridor. Nixon had praised me on how I carried out some of my undercover assignments and Houston plan assignments, which had been given to me.
Now, what were the assignments that he was praising you for, and where did they take place?
The Institute for Policy Studies and some embassies on Embassy Row and a lot of different places around DuPont Circle area, which was multiple. I mean, there must have been dozens of, not over 100 and some. They were all anti-war, anti-Nixon, anti-government type of organizations. They were very radical.
Nixon again wanted to give you props for your skill in doing the covert work. He was comparing you now with some of the top FBI guys. So you were achieving his goals of surveillance, disruption, intelligence gathering. Now, most of these assignments were not pretty, even for deep political operations. But you had no problem with any of it. In fact, he was now calling you a super plumber, which was a reference to his trusted, loyal circle of ex-intel agents that eventually got caught doing the Watergate burglary. But at the time, it must have been a really high compliment.
Yes, he used that word, and then he did praise me for the work. They did give me pet names, and they kept making references to James Bond and...
Interesting. So now he told you he had some new assignments for you. Can you tell me about those?
Well, one was to set fire or to bomb the... When I say bomb, I'm not talking about dynamite or explosives. It was to actually set a small fire within the Institute that was spread and would have caused... Well, could have caused the building to burn down.
Mm-hmm.
The other one was to kill a professor at American University, which he never gave me the name of, but they were going to. But both of those assignments were called off because the break-in happened.
Yes, the break-in changed everything, and it would happen shortly after the second meeting with President Nixon.
Unfortunately, during that particular meeting, I was not aware until a few days later of more circumstances regarding that break-in, and I found out that there was more than one agency involved. There was maybe three, four, possibly even five different agencies all involved in this break-in. And none of them knew what the other one was doing. That was the ironic thing about it. They actually did not know, and they were working independently from each other. Or if they did know what each other were doing, then they were doing it in such a clandestine, competitive way that they weren't going to reveal their position.
That's fascinating. Can you mention some of the agencies that were involved here?
It was the FBI, it was the CIA, it was National Security Agency, it was the military, it was also Interpol. I mean, it was just different agencies and groups involved in the whole thing.
Amazing. So you brought this up, and ultimately Nixon just thought he had it under control, and he ended the discussion around it.
Yes.
Now, how did this second meeting with President Nixon at the White House end?
Nothing spectacular other than the fact that he was concerned about all the publicity that this was going to generate.
Mm-hmm.
He said that if this goes wrong, he said it could go wrong, he said, in the worst sort of way. I remember him saying those words exactly. And as you know, it did. So.
Absolutely. And it was only a few days away. Now, was there any indication at the end of this meeting that you two would be meeting again?
Yes, he did. He said, we'll meet again, and he said that will probably be the last time. Hopefully not, he says, but it probably will be. But I'm going to try my best, he says, to meet with you again. And he did.
Coming up, Robert Merritt discusses his third and final meeting with President Nixon at the White House following Watergate. A distraught Nixon revealed to Merritt the ET presence and a secret time capsule that would someday change history.
And Robert, when did the third and final meeting take place?
The last meeting was in the middle part of July.
Mm-hmm.
And same way as far as getting me into the building, same type of pickup and same circumstances that he was behind the desk, only this time he did not come to the door. He told the agent to leave, go in the hallway and shut the door. And he told me to have a seat, and he didn't even stand up to even shake my hand. He just nodded, and he was holding his head down, and he was visibly crying.
Hmm.
And there was tears actually coming down his face. And I got very quiet. I didn't know what to say and console him. My first inclination was to stand and walk around my desk and give him a hug with my arm on his shoulder or something.
Yeah.
But I mean, he's the President of the United States. You know, you just don't do that. He's not the ordinary man sitting in that chair. He was the President of the entire world, in my opinion.
Right.
But on his desk, he had the copy of the New York Post on there, and it was, I can't remember the headlines, but it was very, very visibly a headline against the president and
mm-hmm.
Leading into something that obviously meant to his demise, and it's true. And I think that's why he was upset and dropped a couple of tears. But he was trying so bad to hold that back.
So he knew right then that this was going to be used to drive him from office, and he was visibly upset. So he used some sentimental language at that point?
At that time he did, yes. He said the only friends he had, and he said, I'm not kidding you, he said, it's Henry Kissinger, he said, and then he paused and he said, you know what, you. And I said, Mr. President, he said, yes. He said, call me by my nickname, Butch. He said, yes, Butch, he said, you. He said, you know what, he said, you've been here meeting me, he said, only a couple of times, he said, the years I've become president and involved in politics, he said, you have shown me very earnest and honest, he used the word love, and he said, the compassion that you show me, he said, is one of a great friendship, and he said, I wished that our relationship had been, you know, much longer and much earlier in the game. And he said, I think with you and the abilities that you have to resolve things and to dissolve things, he said, I wonder if any of this stuff could ever happen. And I felt he was giving me a lot of credit for things that I thought was impossibilities, but.
Wow, an emotional scene there. Can you take us back into this moment again of when you came into the office and you saw Nixon?
Yes, he was teary-eyed, and he actually asked me to see one or two drops come down his face. I didn't know what to do. I mean, you know, he maintained his position on his side of the desk. I'm in a big chair on the other side of him. I didn't feel comfortable, and getting up was, you know, what I wanted to do was to get him, walk around, you know, tomorrow and hug him or something, mm-hmm. to console him. But, God, there might be a camera in here or something that's going to blow my head off if I make a sudden move. I mean, after all, I was still nervous about being next to this the greatest man on the face of the earth as far as I was concerned.
Mm-hmm.
And, but anyways, he cleared up, and he started talking to me. He used to listen. He said, I appreciate everything that you've done. He said, I knew there was things I asked you to do, because he did ask me to have someone assassinated, which we never got a chance to do. But I would have done it for him gladly. I had no problem. I'd already done these things before, and I never had any problem doing it, carrying out the orders. I never had any guilty conscience about anything I did like that anyways. And it wasn't just one. It was multiple.
Well, these covert agencies from the start had programmed you to do that work, and as I understand it, they used the national security reasons. But in any case, I think it gives us some idea of your frame of mind at that time. Now, back to this crucial third meeting. Nixon was actually thanking you.
Yes. Well, he was thanking me, and then he started getting a little serious. He had this letter-sized briefcase, something to hold maybe about 12 sheets of paper, so it's something that somebody would carry, I mean, like a lawyer or something, for to be maybe like on one specific event, something they didn't want to be mixed in with the regular briefcase of all these other things.
Right.
And anyways, he pulled it out, and he read this one piece of paper to me, and basically, again, thanked me for what I did, and talked about, you know, people he could trust, which he limited down to Henry and myself, of course, Henry being Kissinger. But he did not say Kissinger in front of me.
Mm-hmm. It was always Henry.
Until the very end. And then he put that letter in an manila envelope, and he pushed the little metal things back and put a piece of tape, not a piece of tape, but a seal, like a little small gold seal looking, over top of the metal, whatever they called. Then he put a piece of tape across that, and then on the front was handwritten to Henry Kissinger. And he actually had even put the stamps on it. I think he, I don't know, maybe 7-8 stamps. I don't remember what they were, but it was enough postage to cover it.
Uh-huh.
But he asked for it to be hand-delivered or to mail it, whichever was best and safest to do.
Now, this letter was very important. Can you describe the letter for me?
It talked about, there was two red lines, and it was a coded thing. And I don't know how to describe the codes to you except to say that they look like a scientific formula with letters, numbers, and other scientific symbols that would be used, like chemistry symbols,
mm-hmm.
if you know what I'm talking about, because I don't even know if I could even draw them for you at this point in time, but they were very foreign to me.
Okay.
But they were something that I'm sure any college professor would understand in science and biology and chemistry. I'm sure they would understand perfectly what they were. But anyway, it was that. Plus, he was talking about, which he read to me. He said, we have possessed knowledge. He said, and we have in our protection. He didn't say captivity. I thought he did not. I kept thinking, he said, no. He said, in our protection. He said, subjects from the planet X. And I asked him one question, and he didn't seem to like what I asked him, but I thought, well, I'll just keep my mouth shut. I said, are these the things that which you're hearing about, you know, in Mexico or Area 51? But whatever I said, he seemed to be offended by the fact that maybe I knew this or the public had general knowledge of this.
Okay, now this is fascinating. In this final meeting with Nixon, he's reading you this letter. He shows you this formula, and he's now mentioning an alien they have in protection. And he's a little annoyed that you mentioned the being was in custody or being held.
Yes, but not the word he used was protected.
Protected.
Not captured, not in captivity. He didn't use any words that would mean they're against the will of it.
Okay.
But, I mean, obviously, I mean, you know as well as I do, if we had a being like that, yes, it would be in captivity. I mean,
yes.
I don't think we'd let it walk down the street. But he said that the knowledge that we had obtained from it, he said, was so vast. And he said, and so powerful. He said, whoever would possess, he said, would be the most powerful person in the entire world.
Now, from what I understand, you said he mentioned that scientists at Los Alamos had learned to communicate with this being. In your own words now, what did he say about that?
That we had obtained a very vast amount of knowledge from it, and very powerful, that whoever possessed this knowledge and was able to learn from it would be the most powerful person, most powerful nation or government in the entire world and could rule the world.
Rule the world. Now, just to clarify, going back to this ET being for a moment, the formula that was in the letter in red ink, that was the result of the scientists communicating with the ET. It was, in fact, the ET's formula.
Oh, absolutely, yes. Yes, it is, yes. Yes, because he made it very clear. He said, only those who have knowledge, he says, will understand. Red ink. What's written in red ink? And the two lines were written in red ink from a pen, not a typewriter.
Mm-hmm.
That was the only thing that was colored. The other ink was black, and he used a red ink pen to write two lines, and they were symbols, not numbers, not alphabet, but they were some type of symbols.
So it clearly looked like a scientific formula.
Yeah, it looks just like a formula that you would see some brilliant, genius scientist who writes on the blackboard, you know, all this stuff that takes forever and ever to get a simple answer from, and and it was that type of I don't know if you would call it lettering, numbers, I don't know what it would be, but there's nothing that I was familiar with. But it was very carefully done, though, I'll tell you.
Mm-hmm.
He painstakingly wrote those two lines, like he duplicated them from something.
Incredible. Now, what did he tell you that they meant?
He didn't. He didn't. He said only those, he said, who would know. He said would be able to do that. And then there was a handwritten letter. It was actually 2 pages that one letter. And then there was a handwritten letter, he says, also to Henry Kissinger, which he did not read to me, that he said was a personal letter.
Mm-hmm.
And they were the first letter with the to the American people.
Okay, so let's take a look at what the president had here. Can you describe for me what he had?
It was in one envelope, the letter to Kissinger was in another envelope, and then there was 2 cassette tapes in a small padded envelope. And he put everything inside of one large envelope and sealed it up in front of me. And he wrote something over the flap, and it was not his signature. There was nothing on there that indicated that this was coming from the president, or this was the president saying it, or it certainly didn't have the White House or Nixon's name and return address.
Now, you've told me that at some point during this meeting, Nixon actually taped this envelope to your stomach.
Yes, he did. He used some sort of white cloth type of medical tape that doctors use when they finish up maybe a surgery on somebody and they have them quite bandaged up, and they use this white tape. I don't know what they would call it, but that's what it was. It was like a cloth type tape.
And he felt that the contents were a powerful message for mankind.
Yes, he did. He did.
Now, did he ever describe the ET physically?
No.
Did he call it an E.T.?
He didn't refer to it that way. He did not refer to it as a creature, a monster. He didn't use any of those words. He referred to it only as a very sophisticated, very intelligent being. That's the word he used, yes. But he did not describe it as having arms, legs, or eyes, or nothing else. He did not.
Did you feel compelled at all as he was reading the letter to ask him?
No, and he told me not to ask any questions.
Ah, okay.
He told me that he was that's the only part, and the only part of our conversations he told me, he said, before I read this to you, he said, you must not ask me any questions. He said, I will not convince you. He said, it'll be rather offensive to me. He said, if you disobey my request.
In all honesty, as best as you can remember now, and we've seen you have a remarkable memory, what did you think while he was telling you all this?
I guess I'm the Doubting Thomas because I was sort of skeptic about what he was talking about. But I was skeptic only because I have no knowledge of that sort of thing. I've never had any interest in it either.
Uh-huh.
And even though my subject in school, I mean, it was straight A's in science and biology and chemistry, but when it comes down to believing, you know, in outer space life, I don't know. I guess without scientific proof that was presented to us, it was like so many others, I didn't know.
Robert, you were definitely a trusted operative of the Houston Plan, but why do you think he told you this?
Because he said that he didn't trust anybody in the world, he said, except for Kissinger and myself. And I said, why me? I said, Mr. President, I said, you're the most populous person on the face of this earth. You control our all of the military. I mean, the airports, the Navy, the Marines. I mean, everything is at your disposal. The Pentagon, all of you, the chief and commander, I said, of everything. And he said, yes. He said, but you know what? He says, none of them are called Robert Merritt. And he said, they don't have degrees. He says, being the ridge-running hillbilly from West Virginia, either, as you do. And he was simply just telling me that, I guess, in his eyes, I was just a simple country boy who was just being honest.
Do you feel like he wanted you to reveal what he told you about the alien at some point?
Yes, I do. But he didn't tell me when the time was right. I said, well, can you be more specific? He said, you'll be in touch with. And I said, Mr. President, I said, you know, I could die tomorrow. And he said, well, he said, but Henry's still living. And I assume that the only two people on the face of this earth that have that knowledge, other than those who actually work with these things out there in Mexico or Nevada, wherever they're kept, it would be Kissinger and myself. And why me? I don't know. I just cannot answer it. And so it still remains a huge puzzle to me to this day. And it upsets me very badly because of my ill health right now.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know where to go with this. I think that's why I'm hurriedly trying to get this information with you, Daniel, because I don't know where to go with this.
Robert, you're doing a great job of recounting all this. I know the message in the letters is important, and the knowledge we obtained working to communicate with the alien being. Now, Robert, I understand from our conversations that my next question touches on some very important and totally unknown information. But you've said that as President Nixon was reading you the letter, there's a point where he stops and tells you that he has a copy of this letter hidden somewhere in the White House, and no one will find it until the time is right.
That's correct.
A kind of time capsule with this powerful information inside. Now, can you tell me about that?
You know, he did put something away in the White House. I'm not going to say where it is, but it's there.
Okay, well, let me ask you just a little more about this, and I appreciate you opening up as best you can.
Sure.
Now, I understand that you're not ready to reveal the location publicly of the time capsule message, but my question is, do you think that the message is still there?
Yes, I do.
Yeah. Nixon was just clever enough to know where to stash it, where it could remain, undisturbed.
Yes. Yes. And he also said that in time, and he emphasized that word three times like he always did, 3 was his favorite thing. He said it would be discovered.
Well, what is so intriguing for me is that we have the mystery of Nixon reading you this letter about the ET presence. And then he goes further and tells you about saving it as a time capsule of sorts. It's almost as if in getting all of these reports about your talent for memorizing things like license plates and addresses in all these assignments that he sent you on, that he felt in you he had a human recorder, a kind of personal time capsule for all this.
Well, maybe you're the key to that time capsule. Maybe you're unlocking it.
Yes.
I hope. If this broadcast or whatever you do to release this through your media means is to shed light on the president and to show that he was innocent, he was not guilty of these things, then so be it. It concerns me, but the fact even today that even though all this stuff happened is 100% true. How much will anybody believe Robert Merritt? I mean, again, I would have to say I was just a hillbilly from the state of West Virginia, a Ridge Runner. I mean, you know, this is what people want to say. You know, I was not on the White House staff. I wasn't connected. I had no diplomas. I was not an attorney. I was not anybody.
Mm-hmm.
I was somebody he selected. Why he selected me? Well, only God knows, because I don't know the answer to that.
It's quite a powerful mystery.
But anything of any importance that was meant for the public and that the president wouldn't convey, I've done that now. And I just hope I haven't conveyed it too early. Or maybe sometimes I wonder, should I have done this a lot sooner?
Robert, maybe your timing is just right.
Maybe this thing will surface, and maybe it'll service for a good purpose, and to
right.
Eventually one day to clear up the president's name, and that the stigma of disgrace will be removed from his name.
Well, you certainly are setting the record straight now. Little did we know then that there was more to come, as Merritt would reveal to Douglas Caddy that 2020 was a year that Nixon pointed to as pivotal for America and the world. And he would tell me in a follow-up conversation of the frantic search that was set off for Nixon's secret UFO message between President Trump and the CIA, after our exclusive interview revealing its presence in the White House.
That really, in the third meeting, this is really where we get into different territory than the first two meetings, because he's talking about a much bigger secret.
The ultimate secret, really the ultimate secret. Yeah, the ultimate secret. And now you interviewed Robert Merritt.
Yes.
In February of 2018. And anybody can listen to that interview on Dark Journalist, in which Merritt recounts what I just read to you, okay?
Mm-hmm.
But what is not contained in there is the additional information Merritt gave to me earlier this year, subsequent to his interview to you.
Yes.
See, Merritt always withholds things, and I never understood why, but I worked with a retired NYP detective, James Rothstein, who was in who worked with confidential informants for many years. And he told me this is what confidential informants do. They always hold back information. They do so because much of their work is quasi-criminal or criminal. And if they're in a tight situation, they say, well, if you come after me, this is what I'm going to disclose, okay?
Mm-hmm.
This is what I'm going to disclose. Much like Carl Schalker had all the information on who was compromised in Washington. If you come after me, I'm going to name the names of people who've been compromised in Washington, whose sexual misdeeds would. And so this is what the game is all about. It's really what the world is all about. And so Merritt withheld this from your interview, but he wanted this added earlier this year. And what he told me, and which I put in the education form in the Watergate topic of the education forum, which anybody can read, is what we're talking about today. I put that in there in August of this year. And after the president had talked to Merritt about this letter to Kissinger, he added this to Merritt. He said to this verbally to Merritt. It was then that Nixon made a cryptic remark, apparently to emphasize the importance of the assignment that he had given Merritt, which was to deliver the letter to Kissinger. Nixon said, quote, "I took my order from above and have followed it to a T," close quote. Merritt was taken aback by the remark and asked Nixon what he meant. Nixon did not reply directly, but instead declared that, quote, "The year 2020 will be cataclysmic, not only for America, but for the world," close quote. Merritt asked Nixon how he knew this would happen. Nixon replied, quote, "Think of me as a prophet."
Shortly after our interview, I spoke to Robert Merritt again to get details on what he was hearing about the search for the message hidden in the White House. Plans for a full follow-up interview didn't materialize.
Daniel, I just want you to know, my home has been broken into, and my papers have been ransacked, stolen. This computer was damaged, and they erased over 3,000 some names from it.
Oh.
And all my files are gone.
Unbelievable.
And all this is behind, Daniel, the expose is what it's behind.
Yeah. What, when did the break-in stuff happen?
Oh, about 4 or 5 days ago.
What do you think they were looking for?
I don't know what they're looking for, unless they think I have it secretly written down somewhere exactly where it is in the White House. But I want to tell you another thing about that. I got a phone call from a friend of mine who asked me to meet him somewhere, and I did. He's a former intelligence agent. That's all I can say on
it. The line drops sometimes. That does happen.
Oh, okay. He said that about 3 days ago, 2 or 3 days ago, that they went in the White House with a team of people, and they were carrying in thermal imaging equipment.
Wow.
So they're looking for the letter. He doesn't know whether they found it or not, but he said he wouldn't know until the end of next week.
My God, that makes a lot of sense, actually.
Yeah, he's retired from the intelligence, so he's telling me, you know, things that he's getting from friends of his.
Wow, incredible. Thank you for joining us for this historic broadcast, and a special thank you to Douglas Caddy for his diligent research, and most of all to Robert Merritt, who gave us the gift of courage in revealing Nixon's secret UFO message with its major implications for our world today. The rest is up to us. There's more to come in our special deep coverage of Nixon's secret UFO message. Stay tuned. I'll send an SOS to the world. I'll send an SOS to the world. I hope that someone gets mine. I hope that someone gets mine. Message in a bottle. Message in